finally. Solitude. I can read books for all eternity. It's not fair. It's not fair! Wait, my eyes aren't that bad.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas.
Hello and welcome to Sound, Sight, and Mind, the podcast where three brothers dissect and debate the classic series, The Twilight Zone, three episodes at a time. I'm Ken Andrade, and I am joined by educator, musician, man who knows a lot about a lot of stuff, Chris Andrade.
Hello.
And also joining us, illustrator, pop culture know-it-all, sci-fi geek, and you can catch him on Cannibal Horror Cast, Stephen Andrade.
Hello.
All right, guys, so welcome to episode two.
The Quickening.
Perfect. So no one wanted to make a boogaloo joke of any kind at that point.
Well, you're taking the lead on this one, so I leave all the canon films references to you.
Okay, that's my bad.
Yeah.
All right, so last episode we talked about the theme of isolation because that was a major recurring theme in Twilight Zone. In this one, I think is the kind of hallmark of Twilight Zone in general. We're talking about ironic punishment. It is a theme that comes up in so many episodes. So just narrowing it down to three, I think a lot of people would be like, well, what about this one, this one, this one, and this one? But we've got them all tucked away in other categories. But we tried to pick three episodes that included possibly one of the most famous episodes of Twilight Zone ever. And then another very well-known one, and then one that maybe is a little less successful. But we will... Which one will be which? Yeah. So I think let's jump right in, and let's talk about our first episode, which is the very, very famous. I would say, for me, it's probably the most famous Twilight Zone episode, Time Enough at Last. It's directed by John Brom, written by Rod Serling, but based on a short story by Lynn Venable, starring, of course, Burgess Meredith and Vaughn Taylor and Jacqueline DeWitt. First aired November 20th, 1959. We're still in season one. This is episode eight. And why don't we take a listen to Rod Serling's monologue, and then we'll dive right into this guy.
Witness Mr. Henry Bemis, a charter member in the Fraternity of Dreamers. A bookish little man whose passion is the printed page, but who is conspired against by a bank president and a wife and a world full of tongue cluckers and the unrelenting hands of a clock. But in just a moment, Mr. Bemis will enter a world without bank presidents, or wives, or clocks, or anything else. He'll have a world all to himself, without anyone.
Wow, that music sting was odd.
It is pretty odd. I feel like the whole episode, having rewatched it, has a very kind of sitcom-y vibe to it.
Yes.
We'll get into that pretty soon. Let's do a quick summary because I think anyone who knows anything about The Twilight Zone knows this episode, so we don't have to get into too much nitty-gritty here. But basically, you have Henry Bemis. Burgess Meredith is a bank teller, and you first meet him when he's shortchanging a customer because he's trying to sneak a read at David Copperfield. And he's this very charming kind of weirdo who just is so wrapped up in books. But then he gets scolded by his bank manager saying, you know, he's got to get with it, get his head out of the books. And he explains to the bank manager, my wife doesn't let me read at home. She rips the newspapers out of my hand. And then we get a little scene at home with Henry Bemis and his wife, and you see this really cruel trick that she plays on him where she goads him into reading poetry, and he gets all excited that she wants him to read poetry to her. And then he opens the book, and she's blacked out all the pages, and then she proceeds to rip all the pages out and is generally awful. So the next day at the bank, Henry Bemis sneaks off for his lunch break into the bank vault, and he brings with him a newspaper, and there's a headline on the newspaper that says, you know, H-bomb capable of total destruction. And while he's reading, there's a huge explosion. that rocks the whole vault, and he emerges to find the banks in total rubble. He finds the body of Mr. Carsville's boss under a desk, which is pretty grim. And he wanders out in the town, and just the whole place is destroyed. There's no one left alive. He's the last man standing. So then you get a little snapshot of how he proceeds, where he finds a grocery store and he finds food. So he thinks, okay, well, at least I've got that taken care of. I could survive. But then a little later, he starts feeling really lonely and thinks, what am I going to do with myself? And he starts contemplating suicide, until he finds a library with so many books in perfect condition, and he stacks them all up and arranges years and years of reading for himself. And he's finally got time to do it. And then he stumbles, and the giant glasses on his face fall to the ground and shatter, rendering him blind. And he famously says, "It's not fair. There was time now." And that's the sad tale of Mr. Henry Bemis. So,
points for the Burgess Meredith impersonation.
I probably could have done better. It was a little off the cuff. I should have rehearsed. But guys, would you agree with me that this is maybe the most famous Twilight Zone episode?
I think definitely up there. If not the most famous, it's probably tied for first with a couple others. It's definitely the most referenced in pop culture.
Yeah.
There are parodies of this that, you know, you could probably name from all across the decades. I gotta say, on a personal note, even though this is the most famous, this is not one of my favorites. And I will tell you why in a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely up there as one of the top ones. Rod Serling called it one of his two favorites in an interview, along with The Invaders that we talked about last episode.
Right.
And I'm kind of with you, Steve. I still like this one. I remember this one striking me a lot when I was a kid and resonating in some ways. But I agree that in retrospect, it's not as strong as I remember it.
I think, well, one of the reasons that I don't really like it. I like it. I like the episode. I like things about it. But it never really cracks my top 10. And I realized that watching it for this podcast, I feel like I'm too wrapped up in the fact that I'm way too similar to Henry Bemis. And if that disaster ever struck, I would be screwed. Because I also have very bad vision and very thick glasses. And do you have the audio, Ken, of what Henry Bemis says when he finds the library with all the books?
I do. Let me pull that up.
Books! Books! All the books I'll need! All the books! All the books I'll ever want! Shelley, Shakespeare, Shaw! All the books I want! All the books!
I'm laughing because this is literally me every time I go to a used bookstore. I'm like, all the books in the world. So,
and there's
Lovecraft
and there's Matheson.
Yes.
See, I think that's my problem. I'm like, oh, this is going to be me if we ever get into a disaster. But the other reason that I think that I'm rewatching it, I don't like it quite as much, is that a lot of the ironic punishments in literature and in pop culture and, you know, between Twilight Zone and things like Tales from the Crypt or, you know, other stories like that that have like an ironic twist to them, it's usually deserved. The ironic punishment is usually almost like a cosmic karma kind of thing. And if that's the case here, then Henry Bemis deserves to not be able to read books because he wanted to read books too much. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's a little disproportionate.
It almost puts, you know, the right side of the right with his wife and the bank manager, which
Yeah.
Doesn't sit well with me as somebody who would like nothing better to do than crawl into a big pile of books and read. So there's maybe I'm just taking it too seriously.
Well,
I think
with the bank manager, you can kind of get where he's coming from. Okay, you shouldn't be reading a book on the job while you're interacting with a customer if you're screwing up repeatedly because you're not focused.
Sure.
Like, okay, that you get. And if they were going to play it that way, mm-hmm. to say, okay, this guy is just complete head in the clouds and he's, you know, with books to the exclusion of the rest of normal human interaction and, you know, gets punished. But then his wife is such a miserable shrew about it. I mean,
oh my God, she's a stone cold bitch.
the actress does it. She's got this little smile and twinkle in her eye as he's getting ready to read the poems. And you can just see there's this obvious delight in tormenting him. And so you can't help but feel bad for the guy.
Yeah.
And the bank manager, I agree with you that, you know, Henry Bemis should be doing his job as a bank manager. But when he's describing his wife to the bank manager, mm-hmm. and the bank manager says, unasked, I give my reaction to right. this. And then proceeds to be like, she's a very wise woman. You're like, you dick.
You know, if the bomb didn't go off, the bank manager and his wife would start having a torrid affair based solely on depriving Henry Bemis of books.
Such a weird fetish.
I'm writing the sequel.
I think it's one of those things when you have that compressed amount of time in which to tell the story. You know, it's okay. How do we establish he really likes books? It's causing him problems in life, but it's because he's, you know, henpecked and everything else. You know, there's not a lot of room for depth and character development and all that.
No.
Right. And I think the time compression also hurts a little bit in terms of, you know, going through the motions with him post-explosion.
See, right. that I don't mind as much. I actually really like the way that was handled in just the snippets of scenes, because you get everything. It the way it's edited together with, like, the different scenes of him going to different places, you know, going to his house, you know, the where at first he's kind of accepting of it when he has the food and he's, like, just sleeping that night. And then, you know, when he starts having his breakdown, when he realizes he's all alone, I think that's handled really well. And I think that's mostly due to the fact that Burgess Meredith is, I mean, there's a very good reason he's so memorable in every performance he gives in Twilight Zone. And I love the little things that he does as Henry Bemis. Like,
his
like
expressions
said before,
yes. are tremendous. They're just the subtlety. And when he takes those giant Coke bottle glasses off and he mm-hmm. has the perfect, like, faraway look of someone whose eyes aren't quite focused and yet he's still being so expressive. Yeah, his mm-hmm. acting is outstanding.
His little comedic it's almost like a throwaway, but when he's describing Murdstone to woman and she tells him he shortchanged her and he said, oh I'm terribly sorry, Mrs. Murdstone, and right. catches himself. His little stammering is so great.
One of my favorite bits that he does in this is when he gets to the breaking point after the bomb is hit and he's realizing that he's all alone, it's finally hitting him, and he just kind of he's like this little lost kid. He just starts saying, like, help, help, and he just starts off, like, so quietly. It's not like a full-fledged, you know, overly wrought dramatic, like, shouting at the sky kind of thing. It's right. just, it perfectly sums up the character as this tiny, just pathetic little, basically, like, almost like a childlike little person.
Well, when he's got the gun to his head and he's contemplating suicide, and he's not thinking about the pain or the finality, he's just thinking, yes, I think I'll be forgiven for this. I think I would have to be forgiven for this, because in this situation, you know, and it's just, it's so in character. It's so wonderfully done.
Mm-hmm.
The time compression thing in relation to that kind of suicidal breakdown is the part that hangs me up a little bit, just because when you meet him as being such a loner who is all wrapped up in his books, I guess when there's a little less time to develop the breakdown for me, I kind of mm-hmm. wonder, like, would you freak out that much about being alone so fast? I mean,
yeah, I can see your point there.
Obviously, like, that's traumatic. So, you know, your mind might change, but I guess it also, knowing the ending, I'm kind of like, wouldn't he, like, immediately be looking for books? But I don't know. That's that's nitpicking a weird science fiction story. I don't know.
Well, if this were made today, you'd have him, you know, you'd have him fighting his way across the landscape, showing him trying to, you know, get food and do all this, and there'd be blood and guts and gore and you know, all the gritty stuff. One of the things I found in reading up on this episode was they said that this complete unreality, you talked about the sitcom atmosphere, mm-hmm. of the post-apocalyptic world in which everyone is just gone. There's no real trace. There's no sense. It looks like a set on a stage.
Yeah.
It's a blank sky. Mm-hmm. There's big set pieces. Everything's very clean despite being, you know, broken. They said that was really instrumental in allowing the episode to air, because if there had been any more realistic depiction of what a nuclear holocaust would have looked like, it never would have made it to the air, because at that time, 1959, again, we're deep in the Cold War here, this is mm-hmm. really something that is immediate and real and petrifying for people, the prospect of nuclear annihilation.
Right.
And so by doing that time compression, by making it a little bit, you know, overblown, overplayed in terms of the dramatic aspects of it, as well as the comedic aspects, that allowed the story to be told.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to look at it in a more realistic light, like the books and the glasses wouldn't even matter because he'd be dead from radiation sickness within days, probably.
Yeah, just eating that radiated food. And did both of you guys read the...
Or he'd get superpowers.
Yeah. Did both you guys read the original short story?
I did not.
I didn't get to it either. No, do you find it?
Oh, okay. So, wow, I'm the one who read the short story? What the heck?
All right, you get the geek crown for
Hooray,
this week.
I'm useful. In the short story first, there's a little bit of fun foreshadowing in it about his glasses kind of slipping and him, you know, saying like he'd meant to get them tightened. And his wife is not the horrible shrew that she is in the episode. She seems more just kind of like a flighty, wrapped up. She's described as being like addicted to television and playing games with neighbors and stuff. And so she's not as evil about the reading. She just kind of doesn't get it because mm-hmm. she'd rather be watching, you know, variety shows. And then speaking to that, Chris, how you're talking about it wouldn't get on air in the book, there's a couple instances where it describes him kind of stumbling around and then he steps on something squishy and almost gets sick. And there's these little allusions to real carnage. And I almost forgot, but you reminded me, this episode actually has a Serling monologue in the middle, which we should listen to.
That's right.
It sort of describes his touring all the destruction. Let me bring that up.
Seconds, minutes, hours. They crawl by on hands and knees for Mr. Henry Bemis, who looks for a spark in the ashes of a dead world. A telephone connected to nothingness. A neighborhood bar, a movie, a baseball diamond, a hardware store. The mailbox of what was once his house and is now a rubble. They lie at his feet as battered monuments to what was but is no more.
Helen! Helen! Where are you?
I'm dead.
Mr. Henry Bemis on an 8-hour tour of a graveyard.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they do a nice trick with his boss with the dictaphone there, where he hears the voice shortly after the explosion.
Right.
And it's replaying kind of the message about the importance of work, and then it's him practicing a speech to his secretary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really cool, creepy moment in what I would say is otherwise, like, you know, the unremarkably shot episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's none of the weird canted angle stuff. There's not a lot of crazy shadowed lighting. It all is very kind of just flat as is. So that moment, and then, of course, the shot when right before the explosion when the watch shatters, those are like those two visual moments that really pop.
The book flips open and the watch shatters. Yeah, that was a neat little camera trick there. And it looks like sped up motion. Maybe they filmed it quicker.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It doesn't have a lot of the visual flair, but you know, it's just, I think it's Burgess Meredith's performance definitely is what anchors this as being such an iconic episode.
He's super lovable, and I think he deserves better.
There you go. I think the direction is pretty strong, though, too. I mean, obviously he's carrying it, but for example, we talked about some of the, you know, compression of time, but he finds the books and then he has this little books moment, but then there's the jump cut to where he's got them all piled up and arranged in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, this will be this year and this month and next month and then this year and next year. And it just, it very effectively and shortly shows the amount of time and effort and thought he put into it and how therapeutic it was for him, because if you're ever in kind of a crisis situation, you just need to get busy doing something to get out of it. And mm-hmm. he does. And he pours himself into this. And now he's got a plan. And now he's got hope. And then the glasses fall off. So it's not just, you know, a lot of people kind of in their memory of it is, oh, he finds the books, the library, he's happy, and then he breaks his glasses. But it's not just that. He's spent hours, possibly days, going through, thinking about this, arranging stuff thematically, chronologically, whatever, setting up a plan, kind of crafting his own future for the next few years, and that's when the twist comes.
Right.
So it's very, very effective kind of amplification of the whole sentiment.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, it's become the iconic Twilight Zone twisty episode. I mean, what's more brutal and just like than that? I mean, it's kind of perfect, but again, it's pretty mean.
Yeah, he deserves better.
He does.
If we want to shift gears now to maybe someone who does deserve a little bit of ironic punishment, should we move on to the next episode, which is
Nice Place to Visit,
still season one? We're towards the end of season one, episode 28. So this one aired on April 15th, 1960, also directed by John Brahm, same director, written by Charles Beaumont, who is, you know, Twilight Zone vet, starring Larry Bleedon and Sebastian Cabot. Chris, I forgot to ask you about the last one. Is there any musical bits to know about these episodes?
The last one, music was by someone named Leith Stevens, who did a lot of TV, mostly in kind of the horror anthology genre and everything. These next two episodes, though, were just stock music, and it kind of shows.
Yeah.
there's nothing really notable, except, well, there's, we'll talk about it later, but there's not much to talk about musically in these episodes.
Right. So this one is another two-parter for opening monologues. There's a little bit of an action break in it, but let's listen to the first part of Serling's intro to A Nice Place to Visit.
Portrait of a man at work. The only work he's ever done. The only work he knows. His name is Henry Francis Valentine, but he calls himself Rocky. Because that's the way his life has been. Rocky and perilous and uphill at a dead run all the way. He's tired now. Tired of running or wanting. Of waiting for the breaks that come to others, but never to him. Never to Rocky Valentine.
So that's part one of the monologue. Then there's a brief scene where basically the episode opens on Rocky's robbing a pawn shop, and there already appears to be a body on the ground. So
yeah, it looks like, it never says it explicitly, but it looks like he kills the owner.
Yeah, so right away, you know, this dude's bad. He hears that siren coming and runs for it. And then it's funny, the cops show up and immediately start shooting at him.
Yeah.
like you do. And then he jumps up on a fence trying to get away. They try to get him to surrender, and he says, "Not this time, you screw," or something like that.
Lingo.
Yep, that's exactly it.
Love that lingo.
And then shoots back, and as he's trying to hop the fence, he gets plugged in the back a couple times, and then we get a little part two of Serling monologue.
A scared, angry little man. He thinks it's all over now, but he's wrong. For Rocky Valentine, it's just the beginning.
So, Valentine wakes up, and he meets a jolly-looking man in a suit who calls himself Pip. and Pip describes himself as a sort of guide, and Rocky doesn't kind of realize what's happened yet. He tries to rob Pip, and Pip explains, sure, you could have whatever you want. I don't have a wallet. You could have money. No problem. And takes Rocky to his new home, which is this luxury apartment, and Rocky's kind of like, what's going on? What is all this? And they sort of work through the fact that, yeah, you were in a police chase and you got shot, remember? So Rocky thinks, oh man, I'm dead. Okay, I must be in heaven. So I want $1 million and I want girls who are stacked and don't quit and all other great lingo like that. And Pip produces all this stuff for him. $1 million in the drawer. Dancing girls show up. Rocky keeps partying. They go to a casino where he can't lose, and he's just surrounded by money and women, and everything's great. Then later, back at his apartment, he says, hey, I want to see all my old friends. I want to look up my buddies. And Pip explains, no, this is kind of your own private little show here. None of those guys are here. So Rocky's a little bummed out that he's by himself. And also, he's a little confused about why he's in heaven in the first place. So he asks if there's a hall of records, and Pip takes him to this giant filing cabinet area and pulls his record for him. And Rocky sees that it says, like, he murdered a dog, he formed a street gang, he committed burglaries at 7 years old or something like that. So he still doesn't quite get why he's there. You fast forward a little bit, and he's hanging out with girls, and he's super bored of them. He's super bored of winning at the casino. Everything's boring. There's no thrill to any of it. He has to rob a bank, but there has to be a chance he'll get caught. And Pip says, sure, we could arrange for you to get caught, so that's no good. So Rocky says, you know what? Heaven is lame. I want to go to the other place. Where Sebastian Cabot abruptly changes demeanor and says, who says anything about heaven? This is the other place. Brom. And we've learned that Rocky is in his own personal hell.
I really like this one. I think this is the ironic punishment that I can get behind. It's like in the good things come to good people and bad things come to those who deserve it kind of thing.
Yeah, there are a couple interesting things with this, though. I think, first of all, the music, that music cue, the bum, 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 the low brass hit after, you know, Sebastian Cabot's reveal is the worst. it's absolutely terrible. It's like, you know, cliched and badly recorded, and that's awful. So let's get that right out of the way.
I have it if you want to hear it.
Whatever gave you the idea you were in heaven, Mr. Valentine? This is the other place.
I think the script just says menacing flatulent trombone.
I love it. I love it. I'm sorry. I love the cheese. I love the... Like, this is... A lot of times, like, Twilight Zone would try to do humor, and a lot of them where it's supposed to be funny, it doesn't really fly for me. But this one, I think, just has the right amount of, like, black humor. This one really... I know I keep talking about Tales from the Crypt, but this really reminds me of, like, those old EC comics where there's, like, a very gleeful aspect to it. They're reveling in the fact that this guy... Unlike Time Enough at Last, where you really feel bad for Burgess Meredith, and it's, like, an awful thing for that to happen. But this one, you revel in the fact that this this guy is getting what's coming to him. And I think the flatulent trombones just... Perfect.
Kind of from a product of its time thing, they struggled with just how bad they could make him be, because 1960, yeah, you know, coming off the 50s and everything, the dialogue for its time was actually considered super racy for television. When he says, yeah, a chick that won't quit, you know, stacked, you know, that's like, whoa, 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 whoa. There might be children watching.
He says stacked, like, and makes the motion a couple times. It's like, it sounds like he's borderline about to be like, her tits need to be huge.
But I'm going to spell it out for you. Yeah. I want Jane Mansfield.
Well, one of the interesting things is, when I was doing the research, there's one spot where they actually had a special note from the network censors, and it's where the girl says, right when he's kind of starting to get bored, and so he's got the girls with him in the room, and one of them says, is there anything else I can do for you? And then he's like, no, get out of here. And she just kind of looks at him, and it had a note after the first reading, says, be sure the third girl says it sweetly as indicated in the script. So it has to be sweet. There can be no implication that what she wants to do for him is in any way untoward.
But then they linger on that close-up of her making the eyes. It is crystal clear.
Absolutely. But, you know, getting crap past the radar.
Well, and doesn't that make it weird? You know, when after he asks about his friends and Pip tells him they're not here, all this is kind of for you. And Rocky's like, you mean they're props? So that's right before they're going to go to the Hall of Records. So he goes off to the bedroom and he's like, hey, girls, I'm going to go with Fats for a second. And then he lingers in the doorway and gives them a look. And then kind of looks down like he's weirded out. But they don't show you what's in the room. I don't, you know, I'm assuming the girls are there and they're responding to him because he's sort of, you know, talking normal. But I get the impression that, you know, he's like, hey girls, I'm going to go off with Fats. I'll be back. And then he's like, Have I been banging mannequins for the past 6 months? Like, he's kind of like trying to work it out in his head. And you don't know how he feels about it, but it's odd.
One of the one of my favorite lines, Sebastian Cabot, you know, is another kind of iconic actor. He actually had to dye his or bleach his hair for this role so it would match the white suit. They were kind of going with the make him look angelic to set up the contrast and everything. But there's a great line when he thinks he's in heaven. He says, I don't figure it. He says, I thought you had to be, you know, a school teacher or something. And Sebastian Cabot, just with a little, you know, wry look, says, oh, we have some school teachers here.
Yeah.
So as a teacher, I love that. I thought that was great.
And there's also the little line in the casino when Rocky's like, boy, Rocky's hot tonight. And Sebastian Cabot's like, you certainly are.
Right.
It's a great little Easter egg. And that's the stuff that I never would have gotten as a kid.
There are those little tells. And one of them is, if you look, there are a lot of times where the camera angles are just ever so slightly elevated. So not so much that you're, you know, kind of like looking, you know, looking down in a fishbowl or anything, but just the sense that you're looking down at the scene and you're looking down at the scene. I wonder if that was intentional for that reason, just to suggest, no, he's not up high, he's down low, or whether it was just to create distance. But it's there's some interesting camera work in here.
Yeah, well, like I said, this one I think this one's just a lot of fun. Interesting little bit of trivia that I found researching. Apparently, this episode was an inspiration to our current president, yes, Donald Trump, who really identified with the character who just wants to get everything he wants and never lose and wants to win at everything and have lots of money and have his name up in the sky and have beautiful women. And not to get too political, but...
Well, you know, and I had seen that and I was like, gee, did he watch it all the way to the end? And apparently he did, because he says, and then the guy says, no, you're in hell, which he doesn't actually say in so many words, but when have we known Donald Trump to pay attention? But it's weird when he says, yes, it inspired him. I'm thinking, in what way? Like, I want to be that guy, but better at it?
Yeah.
Like, it's weird.
Yeah.
Okay. One last thing for me on this. Okay. The fact that Sebastian Cabot's character is named Pip.
Right. Yeah. What is that?
I was like, what the heck is that about? Because that's not the first name that would pop into your head. So first I'm thinking, okay, you know, again, super geeky here. Seeing if it was one of these codes, you know, like a lot of times, you know, the devil is going to be a guy named Lou Cipher or something like
Angel
that.
Heart.
You know, so I was thinking, okay, is it something like that? Right. Yeah. So So, Pip, I was thinking, if you flip it upside down, it looks like 616, which is actually the alternate number of the beast. Did you know that? There's an alternate number. There are some scriptures that versions of scripture that list 616 instead of 666. And I was like, wow, that would be...
That makes sense because, you know, the devil probably gets a lot of calls, so you got to have a second phone number set up.
There you go. So I figured, okay, wow, that's like super geeky great. And then I found out they didn't translate those scriptures until like 1991. So that wasn't good. So I said, okay, what's the deal with Pip? Because it's not a name that pops in for a big portly guy in a white suit.
Well, maybe that's why.
Who's supposed to be either an angel or devil or whatever. Well, slang. Pip is slang for spots on dice or for the spots on playing cards.
Oh.
So that plays into the character. Okay, but then this I thought was really, really cool, is it's kind of late 19th century British slang, which Charles Beaumont, probably doing all the writing he did and everything, would have been familiar with from doing some character pieces, but it says, to be pipped was slang for being wounded or especially killed by a gunshot.
Oh, wow.
And also, okay, and this is from the same definition, okay, also... from the same period, slang for being defeated at the last moment.
Oh, wow. No way.
Like they say, you got pipped out of the victory was the usage of it, you know? So it was like,
that's actually pretty
so
genius.
Whether or not that was intentional, it's just such an odd name for that character that I was wondering if there was something going on there. So I don't know if there is or not, and nobody knows except Charles Beaumont probably.
And he's dead.
He's not going to tell us. Yeah. But nice I just thought that was kind of cool, you know, that you know, being it's his name is slang for death by gunshot and also for, you know, last moment defeat.
I just thought they were giving him a name that's like, you know, Mr. Happy Face to like, he's not the devil. No, he's just a little Pip, isn't he? Yeah, you are just a
no
Pip.
One who's named Pip can be evil.
Oh, I like it. I think it's fun.
I like that scholarly definition of Pip because that transitions nicely to kind of what you were leading up to that with. In the final episode with Professor A. Demon in the episode The Chaser.
Yes.
So The Chaser, directed by Douglas Hayes and written by Robert Presnell Jr. And this is also based on a short story by John Collier. This one aired May 13th, 1960, stars John McIntyre, Patricia Barry, and George Grizzard. And it's interesting. Let's listen to the monologue.
Mr. Roger Shackleforth, age youthful 20s. Occupation, being in love. Not just in love, but madly, passionately, illogically, miserably, all-consumingly in love. With a young woman named Leela who has a vague recollection of his face and even less than a passing interest. In a moment, you'll see a switch, because Mr. Roger Shackleforth, the young gentleman so much in love, will take a short but very meaningful journey into the Twilight Zone.
Shadoobie.
Yeah,
pretty jazzy.
Pretty slick jazz soundtrack. So, okay, this episode is about the aforementioned Roger Shackleforth, who's this weenie on a payphone trying to call this woman that he claims to be in love with, who clearly doesn't love him back. And that woman is Leela, who you see on a bed eating bonbons like a stereotype. And she's immediately awful. So you get that. So there's this whole line of people waiting to use the payphone after him. And one of them is this apparently wealthy guy who keeps paying his way forward into line so he could be next to use the phone. And when Shackleforth is saying, no, I have to call her again, what if she got disconnected, he hands Roger a card and says, go see this guy, he'll take care of all your problems, he'll fix everything for you. So Roger Shackleforth goes and visits the home of one Professor A. Demon, or I don't know if it's pronounced Damon or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's awful. And he walks
subtle,
in.
Subtle.
Yeah. He walks in and it's this strange library room that the professor's sitting in. And he reveals that he is this purveyor of ointments and potions and salves and all different things. And specifically, he's got this great thing he calls a glove cleaner that's like $1,000 a vial, but it really does the job. And Roger explains, he's just in love with this girl who doesn't love him back, and he needs her to love him back, and it's all he wants in the world. So Professor Demon sells him this love potion for cheap and explains to him that this stuff is serious, and she's going to be completely devoted to you, and even if you cheat on her, she's going to forgive you because she'll just be at your side, and she just wants to make you happy. And Roger's like, yep, that's everything I want in the world. So then he goes off to Leela's apartment and barges in with champagne and bullies her into having a glass of champagne that he's slipped this love potion into, and then also bullies her into giving him a kiss before he goes, and it's just super creepy. And then the potion kicks in, she falls in love, and the, you know, mission accomplished. So we come back to them, what's I guess about 6 months later, I think, after they've been married, and she's just totally doting on him, just hanging all over him, rubbing his back, and he's trying to read, and he's kind of uncomfortable because she's just like cramping his style and she won't leave him alone. So then he's like, I gotta go to a meeting, I gotta slip out of here. And he goes back to Demon's apartment, and Demon's like, oh yeah, you're back, because you need the glove cleaner now, just like every guy always does, and it's going to cost all your savings. And it's basically implied this glove cleaner is poison, it's going to kill her. So Roger, who's an awesome dude, is like, yep, I'll take it. And Demon's like, just make sure that once you decide to do it, that you go through with it, because you're not going to be able to do it again if you kind of stall or waver on it. So Roger goes back home with champagne again. Leela's all excited. He puts the poison in the champagne, and he's about to kill her when she's like, and look, we have something to celebrate. And she pulls out baby booties, and Roger's like, oh no.
And drops like, the glasses.
Yep, forever. And then you pan away to the porch, and Demon's sitting on the porch smoking a cigar and blows a heart-shaped smoke ring and then disappears. And all the whole thing is like, ugh.
You're not a fan.
Yeah, tell us how you really feel about this one, Ken.
I know, not to editorialize it, but I will say this. I will say that I enjoyed the scene after he's given her the love potion when she's hanging all over him, because Patricia Barry is really funny in that scene. Like, he'll go over, it'll be another shot where he kind of goes over and sits down and he tries to, you know, read his book quietly. And then she just kind of slowly slinks into frame over him and starts kind of like massaging him. And it's really some funny kind of physical discomfort humor. Mm-hmm. But other than that, this one is trash for me. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't think it's one of the stronger episodes, but I don't think I disliked it as much as you. Although I got to make a confession. I was misremembering this before I watched it, because I was confusing it with, and again, I'm going back to EC Comics, but I confused it with a Tales from the Crypt episode of the TV show, which was based on an old Tales from the Crypt comic, which was obviously swiped from the same original short story by John Collier.
It was adapted as Love to Death in 1951.
Love to Death. I mean, EC Comics, they were notorious for ripping off Bill Gaines, the publisher, and one of the writers called him Springboards. He'd read all these stories and then he'd use them as the basis for their comic stories. Obviously this one was inspired by the same thing. It's even got the same kind of setup with the, you know, $1 love potion and then the, you know, $1,000 chaser to fix the problem. But in the EC Comics and in the Tales from the Crypt TV version, he puts the poison in her glass, and then he leaves to go answer the phone or do something, and his wife decides that for whatever reason, I think in the comic it was a cup of coffee, and the coffee that had the poison in it was slightly hotter, and she knew he liked his coffee hot, so she gave him that one. So he ends up drinking the poison and dying, and we're like, well, at least I'm alone, and then she follows him into the afterlife because she drank the poison too, because she wanted to be with him forever. So that's what I was remembering that twist when I saw this episode. So the ending with the baby booties, I was like, oh, okay, that's different than I thought.
I like that a lot better, but actually.
I still think, I mean, I think there's some things in here that are really cool. I love the set for Professor Damon, mm-hmm. the library set. And I'm also, I wonder about the significance of the fact that his building number is 22, mm-hmm. because there's another Twilight Zone episode called 22 where a woman is plagued right. by nightmares of the room 22, and somehow it's omen of death. And I'm wondering if that has any significance or if it's just a weird coincidence in this case.
If it's some Twilight Zone shared universe.
It could be.
Actually, I think this episode is shared with Harry Potter, too. Let me tell you my theory about that. I'm going to retroactively put Twilight Zone into Harry Potter. You notice that Professor Damon wears a striped scarf.
I did catch that.
Now, you can't tell the colors, obviously, because it's black and white, but given his general attitude plus his mastery of potions, I would guess that he was a Slytherin who did some shady shit, had to emigrate to America, and now makes his way selling love potions and poisons.
That makes Roger Shackleforth totally a Hufflepuff.
He is, well, yeah, definitely.
I have to say, for me, this was a kind of obvious premise that was saved by some really good actors. John mm-hmm. McIntyre as the professor is incredible. He was on Wagon Train for years. He has a huge filmography, just been in all sorts of things. His final role was actually in the film Turner and Hooch before he passed away. So, I mean, his career spanned decades, but he is absolutely fantastic as the Professor Demon there, because it's just, he seems so kind of weary of the whole thing, like, oh, here comes another one, and I'm going to tell you what you want, mm-hmm. and you're going to tell me no, this is what you really want, but it's always going to be the same. And he lays it right out there, and his demeanor is just wonderful. I didn't think I was going to like the lead, George Grizzard or Grizzard or however he pronounces it, because it's poorly written. I think that, yeah. you know, the whole mm-hmm. his opening lines to her over the phone and everything are just so pathetic. Again, they've only got a little time to establish it, but he actually does a really good job in that scene where, like you said, Patricia Barry is just hysterical. You know, oh, would you like this? Oh, well, how about this? You know, and he's doing a good job of kind of being exasperated and doing it. He actually won a Tony Award for the Edward Albee play, A Delicate Balance. He did a bunch of Albee stuff. So he was doing all this, you know, theater of the absurd. And he was in the original production of, I think, of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, too, as the male of the young couple. So he's, you know, he's got some serious acting chops too. But
he's well versed in awkward relationship.
Exactly, exactly. It's kind of, I mean, it's kind of what he does. That's what Albee plays are, is just 2 hours of discomfort on stage. Brilliant discomfort, but yeah. But it's, you know, it's kind of an obvious setup and everything, and even the, you know, the little cheesy bit with the heart shaped smoke ring and everything. But there is, like you said, that glee and that Tales from the Crypt element. It's obvious why it worked, you know, why it worked so well for that as well. The one thing I found interesting was with the baby booties and things. One of the things that what's the character's name?
Roger Shackleforth.
One of the things he says when he goes back the second time and he's trying, well, no, I don't necessarily want the poison. Can't we put some of that love onto some, you know, someone else for a little while, you know? And
right.
when you think about it, okay, here's the, you know, the doting wife who's excited about being a mother. And you would think in the traditional, you know, kind of, you know, roles that you think of late 50s, early 60s for that was that, the, you know, she would become the doting mother, and that, well, that takes care of the problem. You know, there's that, you know, mm-hmm. a new outlet for the love. And you wonder, well, how's that going to play out based on, you know, what we said, and just that the idea that the baby just anchors them together forever now is kind of a dated, weird look at
That's why the episode leaves a bad taste in my mouth, or maybe I'm just being overly sensitive. But like, it's sort of played as like a wah wah moment when she's like, look, a baby, and we're there forever. So you get the look of misery on his face because he was definitely about to kill her.
Right.
And then she's talking about a baby, but I'm wondering, okay, but after she has the baby, is that love going to transfer to the baby, or is this poor baby going to exist in a world where the father hates it and she's still just like completely devoted to Shackleforth?
Right.
And it's... I'm just like worried about this imaginary baby's safety.
We can extrapolate a very dark turn for this episode.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's
which is why I found the short story really interesting, because I thought after I read it, I was like, that's it. There's got to be stuff missing. But the short story is just that initial meeting between the professor and his name isn't Roger Shackleforth in the story. I don't remember what it is, but
I don't think it's even given a name. I think it's just referred to as the young man.
Yeah. And it's really fascinating because he goes in talking about how he's in love with this woman and it's unrequited. And the professor's talking about the glove cleaner and it just kind of reinforces that whole thing of yeah, I could give you this potion, but sooner or later everyone comes back for exactly what they need. And it has this whole kind of foreboding element to it without really getting into the nuts and bolts of having to see, you know, these two terrible people.
Yeah.
And the outcome. And then I just don't like the demon hanging out on the patio chair and then disappearing. It just feels like...
Well, he's not a demon. He's a former Hogwarts professor. And he disappeared.
Right. We forgot the fan theory. Sorry.
That's right.
Well, one thing that's never really addressed, kind of for me, the elephant in the room with this is, okay, he has this glove cleaner. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? And right away, the guy is like, oh, so this will solve the problem, you know, because I'll get rid of her. Is, you know, the professor never says that. He could be offering him the way out. Here's how you get out. Look, you can just, it won't leave a trace. No one will know. You'll just pass and completely undetectable. And you get out. But his assumption is, well, I'm going to use this to off her. Now, clearly that's, right. You know, there's a question too. So when you talk about the, you know, ironic retribution kind of thing, ironic punishment, you know, he's always thinking about himself. You know, when he slips her the love potion, she doesn't love him, but he's got to have her. And then when he grows tired of it, he goes to take her out of the picture. He doesn't go to leave. So it's, you know, he's not a good guy there.
No.
And I thought the way they staged it, I thought it was going to wind up, Steve, kind of like you said, with the switching of the glasses. Because as she's kind of going all over him, he's juggling the glasses and turning around. And there's this almost moment's hesitation where, wait a minute, is it my right hand or my left hand? So I was kind of expecting it to go that way, too. And then instead just to drop them both and because of the baby, that was kind of, oh, all right. So that's how it is. Again, I think it's a product of the times thing, you know, the male-female roles and all that. One of the things that bothered me in the previous episode we discussed, the nice place to visit, is when he goes to the Hall of Records and they're reading off everything he's done. And you're talking about someone who's a sociopath from the age of 6. The first thing is slaughtered a dog at age 6. And he says, well, it bit me. And then it goes and goes through. And I think Ken said, yeah, by age 9, he had organized a street gang. Nowhere in that catalog is a list of poor choices he made where he had the chance to do something different. It's like, this is just a messed up guy. And now he's being punished. In The Chaser, again, there's no real thought to deeper moral questions or anything like that. It's all very black and white. Here's a miserable person. She's a miserable person. They both kind of get what's coming to him in a way, because she, you know, she was toying with his emotions and, again, shown the shallow bonbon eating, you know, whatever. And now she's, you know, her life,
although she seems happy, at the same time, she's got no free will anymore, essentially.
Right.
So there's a punishment in there as well, and it's all very cut and dried.
I don't know what it says about me that, at least in terms of watching a character and kind of rooting for a character, I give Rocky Valentine a little bit of a pass just because he's sort of charming and he brings a little bit of a lovability, even though he's a sociopath, like you said, and he's done terrible things. But just the way you're introduced to Shackleforth in this episode in the most weeny way possible, I'm out. I don't, I don't care.
He's whiny, he's self-centered, he's inconveniencing everyone around him in his pathetic pursuit of this girl. He's, yeah, not likable in the least.
But, I mean, I think that character trait is what... It does remain constant through the end, because he's got no real strength of character. Like, he's set all his eggs basically in the basket of getting this girl, and then when it doesn't work out to make him happy like he thought, he wants to get out of it. But even at the very end, when... You know, she shows him the baby booties. I believe he says something along the lines of, like, that's okay, I never could have gone through with it anyway.
Right, right.
So, like, he just has no strength of character at all. Like, the only thing he thought he wanted was just to have this woman be with him. And then he realizes that that's not what he wants, and he doesn't know what he wants. But he's just, you know, he is kind of a pathetic little character. And yeah, I do agree, like, and that's probably one of the reasons that Nice Place to Visit is more enjoyable to watch, because there is a more interesting personality at play there as your protagonist.
Yeah. Anyone else have any final thoughts on any of these episodes?
I can't wait to talk more about in the future about other Burgess Meredith episodes, because
he was awesome.
And I mean, there's a very good reason that when they made the Twilight Zone movie in the 80s, they had him do the introductions for each segment. Because he's, right, out of all the actors who have ever been on Twilight Zone, and there have been many who have done multiple roles, but he's definitely, I think, the most iconic actor when you think of Twilight Zone. That's usually who you think of, aside from Rod Serling, of course.
Right.
And fun Twilight Zone, the movie bit, too. Patricia Berry plays Leela in The Chaser. Yeah, she's the mom in It's a Good Life.
That's right.
Segment of the Twilight Zone movie.
The shit you say.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
She wins me over big time in this episode because, you know,
well, again,
her intro is rough.
Yeah. But you just think,
yeah, her performance is great.
Yeah, her first scene is like, oh, I'm going to hate this one. Well, the two of them, it's almost like the stopover in A Quiet Town was going to be just another thoroughly unlikable couple, but yeah, they definitely bring something
to it. Patricia Berry definitely has comedic timing. And like the scenes where she's, you know, all over him and fawning over him. But even before that, after he drugs her the first time and, you know, gets his kiss from her and it doesn't work right away. And then there's the, you know, he goes to leave and she's like, wait, Roger. And she like goes back again. And just like those little things, like she does a really good job of having a lot of fun with a very one-dimensional character.
All right, maybe I'll have to lighten up and watch it again.
Oh, no, I mean, it's not... I don't think we're wrong and all in agreement that it's not a great episode. It's not one of the best ones. It's not one of the more memorable ones. But I think it's a little bit of fun fluff. You know, it doesn't really have anything to say about the human condition or anything that, you know, pops up in some of the more iconic ones. But, you know, that's part of the fun of doing this podcast is that you look at a lot of different episodes and they can't all be, you know, knocks out of the park.
Right. Real quick, did you wonder what the story would be behind the guy who gives him the card to go see Professor Damon?
I wanted to find out why he was so adamant that he needed the phone.
Right.
Like, yeah, there's something going on in that story.
Right. Is he in...
And he's throwing money around in an unusual way and clearly... He's visited him for something, so I was kind of pondering that one, like, what's that guy's deal?
I wondered, you know, to what degree he was just, you know, the
diabolical agent himself? You know, was he a minor demon in the employ of Professor A Demon?
No.
No, you don't. Is he a Death Eater? You don't think so? You don't think
he was? I don't entertain that at all. No, I think it was more a case of lazy screenwriting. It's like, we need to get this guy to this professor. How do we introduce it? All right, this guy who's in line behind him, he just needs to get the phone, and he'll give him a card. And then, you know, maybe the director is like, well, why did he have the card? I don't know, because he just does. He's got the card. You have cards in your wallet.
Oh, I don't buy that.
You don't know where they're from? It's like, I've got cards in my wallet from every place. I don't know where they came from. But yeah, I would like to see his story.
Well,
where's that sequel? The Chaser Part 2. There's your Electric Boogaloo right there.
There it is. Full circle. There. Perfect.
Get on that.
So yeah, ironic punishments, a staple of this series. And there are many more examples of that kind of ending that we'll see in future episodes. Now, next episode of this podcast, we're going to tackle another subject, which is yet another one that's it's a theme that pops up a lot in Twilight Zone again, and we're going to talk about some big episodes in that one. Chris, you want to tease that one for us?
Well, we are looking at Paranoia, and one of the all-time great episodes, a personal favorite of mine, is Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. That was always saved for somewhere near the end of those marathons they do on New Year's Eve, because it was just such an incredible story. Now, I hope when I go up back to rewatch this one, I don't come away thinking, rats, that's nowhere near as good as I remembered. But it seems to be the recurring theme here. But but just the idea of paranoia and you know, we have met the enemy and he is us kind of thing, where what we do to ourselves is worse than anything that the spooky universe can throw at us.
All right. So if you want to complain about anything we've talked about or said, where's this episode? You could email us at ssmpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And Steve's got a Facebook page that's going up. And we could actually put links on the Facebook page to the short stories, because they're online. We could link to some of that stuff. And anyone got a good catchphrase to go out on?
Oh, God, I'm terrible at catchphrases.
Okay, I got one. Ready for this one? In Soviet Twilight Zone, dimension enters you! Huh? Better than last week's.
Keep working gosh. On it.
Oh my gosh. That was painful.
Yeah, well,
that was. I think I need to go lie down.
Yeah.
Say goodnight, all Gracie.
Right. All right. See you next time. Bye.
Cold pie!